I thought what I'd talk about today is a meeting that Bodhidharma had with the Emperor of China very soon after he came to China. It's a very well-known dialogue, conversation, and it's worth just looking at because there are some important elements of teaching that he gives there in his hallmark uncompromising style. It's said that Bodhidharma was an Indian monk, and as it said in the offertory today, that he was the son of the king of southern India. Scholars actually disagree whether he ever existed or not. From our point of view, it really doesn't make any difference. The teaching came somehow from India to China and was passed on. Some individual, or more than one individual, carried on the transmission from Shakyamuni Buddha down to the Chinese ancestors. And whether that person was called Bodhidharma or not is neither here nor there. Our tradition is based on the practice and the teaching, not on the history. Even though there might not be any compelling evidence for Bodhidharma existing, I don't think there's any compelling evidence that he didn't. And for 1500 years or so, he's been honoured as the founder of Chan and Zen Buddhism in China, and then all the traditions that flow from that. Traditionally, it's said that Bodhidharma trained in India with his teacher, who was called Prajñātara, and it's said that Prajñātara was a female monk. His master was a female teacher. And it said that it was her suggestion that he come to China. And he was already quite elderly when he did that. It was a long, long voyage, several years, and eventually he ends up in China, and it's soon after that that this dialogue takes place. And it's mentioned in a number of different sources, I think. Perhaps they all get back to one source. Dogen retells the story in one of his chapters in the Shobogenzo. And it's a very long chapter that's often broken into two parts called Ceaseless Practice, or Gyoji. And this is near the beginning of the second half of that. On the 21st day, the 9th month, the 8th year of the Putong era of the Kingdom of Liang, which apparently is 527 CE, Zhao Ang, governor of Guang province, officially welcomed Bodhidharma. Carrying out his duty, he reported Bodhidharma's arrival to Emperor Wu. It was the first day of the 10th month. Reviewing the report with delight, Emperor Wu sent a messenger to Bodhidharma to invite him to the palace. Bodhidharma went to the capital city of Jinling and met with Wu, who said, "Ever since I became emperor, I have built temples, copied sutras, and approve the ordination of more monks than I can count. What is the merit of having done all this?" Bodhidharma said, "There is no merit." The emperor said, "Why is that so?" Bodhidharma said, "These are minor achievements of humans and devas, which become the causes of desire. They are like shadows of forms and not real." The emperor said, "What is real merit?" Bodhidharma said, "When pure wisdom is complete, the essence is empty and serene. Such merit cannot be attained through worldly actions." The emperor said, "What is the foremost sacred truth?" Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, nothing sacred." The emperor said, "Who is it that faces me?" Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." The emperor did not understand. Bodhidharma knew that there was no merging between the two and the time was not ripe. Thus, without a word, he left on the 19th day of the 10th month and travelled north of the river Yangtze. He arrived in Luoyang in the kingdom of Wei on the 23rd day of the 11th month of the same year. He stayed at the Shaolin Temple of Mount Song, where he sat facing the wall in silence day after day. But the Emperor of Wei was unaware of his presence and was not ashamed of being unaware of it. But it's a bit odd. It's very odd. Other translators say he was unaware of his presence, and even unaware that he should be ashamed of that, which I think makes more sense. I'm not sure how you can be ashamed of being unaware of something. It just, there's just a kind of logical impossibility. Makes you wonder, well, should I be ashamed of all the things I'm unaware of?
You should be, yes.
I probably should. It's obviously not really an important part of the thing, but I'm mainly going to go from this translation, which is Ta-Nehisi et al. But there are a few phrases where it's useful to look at another one, and this other one is the one by Nishijima and Cross. But the ruler of the Wei dynasty also was too inept to recognize the master, and he did not even know that this was cause for shame. That makes a bit more sense. So anyway, going back to the beginning, Bodhidharma's arrived in China. The emperor welcomes him, and he reviews the report with delight that Bodhidharma has arrived, and Bodhidharma comes to the palace. And the emperor's first question is, ever since I became emperor, I have built temples, copied sutras, and approved the ordination of more monks than I can count. What is the merit of having done all this? We're not there. We can't tell what the emperor's state of mind is in asking that. We can't see the expression on his face. Is he very smug and self-satisfied and wanting Bodhidharma to praise him for all, how much he's been doing? Or is he deeply anxious and unsure? Has he done enough? What's the merit of what I've done? Has it been enough? And whether it's either of those two, or whether it's something else, it's clear to Bodhidharma that there's an issue there that he needs to point to. If the things that the emperor has done are just pure offerings, they're just gifts, then why focus on the merit? Why focus on what you get out of it? The very fact that the emperor is asking about what he is going to get out of it shows that there's something there in the intention of the emperor that is worth just drawing out and drawing some attention to. The background to this, of course, is that the emperor will be thinking that through making offerings, supporting the monks and the temples, and it sounds like actually he has genuinely done a huge amount to support Buddhism in his country. It's easier to just write him off because Bodhidharma's reply, but actually it sounds like he has done a huge amount. There would have been, it's clear in his mind, a thought or an expectation that as a result of having done that, there'll be some benefit, some merit that accrues to him. And often people might have thought that of that in terms of being reborn in a more favourable rebirth in the next life, or something like that. Being the emperor of China, or at least part of China, seems to have been done all right, actually. Not too bad so far. But of course, if we're looking for possessions, looking for gaining things, whether they're spiritual things or physical things, however much we've got, we always want more. Even if you're the emperor of China, you want more merit. Bodhidharma says, there is no merit. And that's pretty uncompromising. He doesn't say, oh, well done, but actually there's a bit of an issue here. He says, there is no merit. And we're not there. We can't see the emperor. We can't tell what teaching would be helpful for the emperor. Bodhidharma clearly thinks that the way the emperor is, and obviously, presumably the emperor is pretty sure of himself. He didn't get to be emperor of part of China, even part of China, by being kind of hesitant and self-doubting. So Bodhidharma's response is pretty strong. He says, there is no merit. Why does he say there is no merit? What he's pointing out is that if we give things with an idea that we will get a reward as a result, if that's our motivation for giving things, then it's not a pure offering. It's still in the world of contracts, of trading, of negotiating. I would all these things if I get this, that, or some other thing as payback, as a reward. That isn't the true heart of giving. The emperor has done a huge amount, and I'm sure it sounds like it was very, very valuable for supporting Buddhism. But what Bodhidharma is pointing to is the heart of the practice. What is the heart of giving? The emperor is able to do a lot because he's got a lot. He's very rich. Someone who is very poor will, in material terms, be able to give very little. But the important thing from a practice point of view isn't the size of the offering, or even the size of the offering in relation to what our resources are. The important thing is the motivation, if you like, the aspiration, the intent with which the offering is made. If it's an offering that's simply given, no strings, open-handed offering to benefit all beings, not even with the view of benefiting all beings, just an open-handed offering, because that's good to do, then the thought of what merit we receive doesn't occur to us, because it's a gift, it's an offering. If we are wanting a reward or seeking something, then it's no longer that pure giving. Paradoxically, when we just give in an open-handed way, actually we do benefit. We benefit enormously from the open heart of giving. If we're giving in order to get something, then we don't benefit to that extent, certainly, because it's, as I said, it's not that much different from drawing up a contract which binds both parties. I will give that if I get this in return. To the extent that that mind creeps in there, that diminishes the pureness, the openness, the simplicity and straightforwardness of the giving. The emperor maybe wasn't in a position to listen to subtleties at that time, so Bodhidharma's not subtle. He doesn't discuss the technicalities of it. He says, no merit. You could say he's being a bit harsh, actually. There was all sorts of benefits, I'm sure, that accrued to the people who received all the gifts that the emperor bestowed on Buddhism. All the temples that he built, all the scriptures he helped have translated, all the monks he supported. It's rather harsh to say there's absolutely no merit in that. But there is something real that Bodhidharma is pointing to, is that it's not actually about the outcomes, it's not about causes and effects. It's about looking at what our intention is and clarifying what our intention is over and over again. And whether it's literally true or not to say there is no merit, that's great teaching for the emperor, to point out to him that it's about intention, it's not actually about the stuff. So Bodhidharma's answer, it's not about accuracy of his answer, it's about giving a teaching, it's about pointing a direction. And from the point of view of aspiration, of intention, of the open heart, Bodhidharma is clear, there is no merit. The emperor, I think we just have to imagine the look on his face. If he was full of himself and wanting to be praised, and had a smile on his face, a grin, as Bodhidharma said, there is no merit, you can imagine that grin becoming rather fixed. To his credit, he says, why is that so? Why is there no merit? He doesn't say, off with his head. Why is that so? Bodhidharma said, these are minor achievements of humans and devas, which become the causes of desire. They are like the shadows of forms and not real. He's pointing out that this is all still in the realm of cause and effect. It's all about humans and their doings. Someone with great resources can make a great gift. Someone with small resources can make a small gift. But if we're attached to the outcome, then they become causes of desire. we still have attachment to what we're doing and what the effects of it are. It's not just an open-handed offering. They are like shadows of forms and not real. A couple of the other translations, both Nishijima and Cross, but also Reverend Master Hubert's translation, that sentence, they say, they are like shadows following the form. Though they exist, they are not the real thing. And I find that helps to just bring out another aspect of it. They're like shadows. They do exist. What the Emperor is doing is real. It does have an effect. Shadows do exist. But if we take shadows as being the thing that they're the shadow of, then we're confused. To take the giving of the items as being the important thing is to miss the point of giving. The point of giving is the open heart. Again, as I say, the amount we can give is dependent on our resources, and that's different for everyone. But to focus on the resources, to focus on the amount of the giving, is to be focusing on the shadow, not on the real thing, which is the heart of the giving. Of course, the heart of the giving, the intention, has to be expressed. If we say, oh, I have an intention of giving huge amounts, but we don't actually give anything, then what's the reality of that intention? So the two go together, and the focus of it, the important part, is the true intention. These are minor achievements of humans and devas which become the causes of desire. They're like shadows following a form. Although they exist, they're not the real thing. And the Emperor, again to his credit, asks, what is real merit? It sounds like he's hearing Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma's pointing out that the real merit doesn't lie in the quantity. So what is real merit? Bodhidharma says, when pure wisdom is complete, the essence is empty and serene. Such merit cannot be attained through worldly actions. Real merit comes when pure wisdom is complete. It comes through our understanding of practice, our giving ourselves to practice, not through material things, however enormous they may be. This other translation has pure wisdom being subtly all-encompassing, the body being naturally empty and still. However it's translated, it's pointing to the importance of our own practice, the importance of the inner practice, not about the outward expression of it. Where does real merit come from? It's not through achievements. It's through giving ourselves wholeheartedly. It's through the wholehearted engagement with what we see as being important. The extent to which, in a practical dimension, we can engage with that is different for all of us, because we all have different attributes, we all have different abilities, we all have different resources. But it's not about that external manifestation of it. There has to be an external manifestation for each of us. And what is real merit? It comes from the heart of the practice. It comes from giving ourselves to it. It comes from our intention, our wholehearted engagement with life, with the living of life in a way that's in harmony with what we understand to be true. There's no mention in here of whether the Emperor gets that, whether he connects with that, whether it's something he understands. He asks another question. The Emperor said, what is the foremost sacred truth? And quite similar to his earlier response, Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, nothing sacred. In other translations, the Emperor says something like, of all the truths, which is the most sacred, which is the most holy thing? Which is the most holy teaching? Bodhidharma says, in other translations again, he simply says, there is nothing holy. Again, it's a direct response, a very uncompromising response to the Emperor. There is nothing holy. the emperor's whole worldview, sounds like, involves seeing some things as holy and sacred and worth doing, and other things as mundane. Bodhidharma saying there is nothing sacred, or there is nothing holy. He's not saying everything is unholy. What he's saying is that because the whole universe is Buddha, everything is complete, true as it is. There's just no basis for dividing things up into holy and unholy, sacred and profane. When everything is Buddha, the question of what is holy doesn't make sense anymore. And it's not that everything is totally holy or that everything is totally unholy. It's just that we don't put it on a scale. We don't draw up a scale of unholiness. Vast emptiness, nothing sacred. What does the other translation have? Yes, this is quite interesting, actually, this translation. It says, what is the paramount truth among the sacred truths? And Bodhidharma replies, it is that which is glaringly evident and without anything sacred. That which is glaringly evident. What's the most sacred of everything? It's that which is glaringly evident. It's the nature of things. The basic truth that's right in front of our eyes that we can all connect with. It's not some esoteric doctrine, which is perhaps what the emperor is asking for. Tell me what the most sacred truth is. Well, it's right in front of your eyes. And there is no sacred. The most sacred truth is that there is nothing sacred. The most holy understanding is that there is nothing holy. It's seeing our life and seeing the world in a slightly different way. The emperor then says, who is it that faces me? Again, we don't know quite what his state of mind is. Maybe he's just fed up at this point. Or maybe he's indignant. Why aren't you giving me some decent answers? They're not the answers I wanted. You're meant to be praising me. I'm the emperor. I think that Master Hubert has something like, who are you that has the temerity to speak to me like this? Or something like that. It's not quite that. Bodhidharma says, I don't know. There are a number of ways we can interpret that. Reverend Master Hubert says, I personally do not know that person, or something like that. One interpretation is simply that Bodhidharma feels actually he needs to do more practice, he needs to clarify things more for himself. He can't actually express that. And, of course, after this interchange, he heads north and goes to Shaolin and spends many years facing all to clarify things more and more. But there's another way you can look at it, that he's saying the real truth of things, when you say, what is it that faces you, the real truth of this being is not something that a self can entirely encompass. There is this self, this body and mind, it's an expression of the whole truth which is here, but it can't encompass it, it can't fully know it. But even though it can't fully know it, it expresses it in just being there. Who is it that faces me? Bodhidharma says, I don't know. And then Dogen says, the emperor did not understand. It's not clear whether he means he just didn't understand that last one or he didn't understand the whole lot. But either way, Bodhidharma felt that there wasn't really a meeting of minds. Although Buddhism had been in China for a long time, the meditation tradition hadn't been there really. It's Bodhidharma who brings that. The tradition was one of making offerings, performing ceremonies perhaps, living by the Vinaya, reciting scriptures, copying out scriptures, a lot of very good things, but meditation wasn't the heart of it, it sounds like. Bodhidharma is answering from the perspective of meditation. It's not surprising, really, that the emperor doesn't understand. But Bodhidharma feels that the time isn't ripe for pushing it further. Maybe he's just a bit worried about his personal safety. given what he's just said to the most powerful man in the country. Either way, he felt that the time was not right. Thus, without a word, he left on the 19th day of the 10th month and travelled north of the river Yangtze. And it's there that he comes to the monastery Shaolin, which is already a Buddhist monastery at that time. And it's there that he spends many years sitting facing a wall, and there that his disciple Ekka and other disciples as well come to him, and that's from where Chan Buddhism in China starts and grows from there. And I can imagine that Bodhidharma's experience of having met the emperor and having been asked very direct questions and having had to come up with an answer was something that prompted him to realise that, yes, he really needs to be sure for himself, how are things, what is the nature of reality, the nature of this being, the nature of practice. And so he goes off and focuses on that and sits at Shaolin practicing.